And on RN, it's hello from David Rutledge. Welcome to today's edition of Earshot. Today, a speculative excursion into a landscape of ideas about place and history. We're going to meet two writers on either side of the Pacific Rim who are each absorbed in mapping the resonances of place. Nadia Wheatley in Sydney and Rebecca Solnit in San Francisco. What place means to us is very personal, but it's also where we converge with others in a larger story. Our place marker and audio guide is longtime RN broadcaster and writer Robin Ravlich.
Moving to Sydney's bushland fringe from the inner city a few years ago, I travel between my past and present worlds, mostly by train, watching in reverie from the window an elusive ribbon of suburbs unfurl across terra incognita, familiarising myself with the terrain beyond. Writing a memoir during this time, I found myself absorbed in thought, noting dates on shop facades, chimneys on older houses, their absence on newer ones, factories decorated with graffiti, nestling into land by waterways. Buildings disappeared as others rose with the speed of time-lapse photography. This was disturbing. The old was eliminated, replaced by new. The landscape altered, leaving me to puzzle over what was there before, just weeks ago. When the ABC moved across town years ago, I eased the dislocation by walking around the streets of Haymarket, looking into shady doorways of Chinatown and the decrepit vegetable market halls, marking out territory and making it mine by following in the footsteps of Arthur Stace, Mr. Eternity.
I've always been interested in how your identity is really geographically contingent.
Rebecca Solnit is a San Francisco-based American writer whose books I find physically beautiful and philosophically engaging. Her latest is The Encyclopedia of Trouble and Spaciousness.
You know, I once wrote that place is not a discrete entity. It's a crossroads where many forces intersect, but the particular things that intersect, you know, in Kyoto, Japan, are so different than what intersects in Reykjavik, Iceland, for example, to mention two places in the book. And I think that it's something that interests us all a lot, as place seems to be getting erased by kind of generic non-places, airports and shopping malls and shops like Starbucks. But, you know, I've always been very tied to place.
Rebecca is an historian, activist, and poetic, unconventional memoirist of place.
Places are always these complex cross-pollinating and conflicting sets of multiple systems, multiple stories, multiple peoples and cultures. And tracing them, I think, lets you know where you are, which is a profound thing, partly because it's so easy to not know where you are now, where people navigate by their phones and never learn the way around and don't even really look around that much sometimes.
To know your place was once an admonition. Now it's making sense of powerfully shaping forces in our lives and landscapes.
We don't necessarily know exactly where we are at all. Some people know very little about it. They don't know where their water comes from, where their garbage goes, or who was here before them, or why it has the names it does, or how the weather systems work, or any of those things.
Place is firstly a geographic location. Place is where we live, where we grow up. But place also relates to our position in our community, in our society, our identity and our role. And that is what I'm exploring very much in the book, My Place.
This is a place where I feel.
Nadia Wheatley is an historian, biographer and novelist who wrote the beloved children's book My Place illustrated by Donna Rawlins. A rendering of generations of kids' lives in the world around them, within one small area of Sydney, traversing the 200 years between 1788 and 1988.
The place where we live is, of course, the vital thing to us. And this is particularly important, I think, for children growing up. Children develop a connection with their place, a connection with their neighbourhood, which is part of shaping themselves and their identity, that will be part of that shaping factor or shaping force for the rest of their lives.
When I was growing up, this may relate or resonate very well for Australians, we were really like colonial subjects, reading books about wars that had not been fought anywhere near us. And even the poems, I just remember being full of snow and autumn leaves and all these things and spring and babbling brooks on the surface that would, of course, completely dried up in our Mediterranean climate. So San Francisco is a kind of non-Eurocentric Pacific Rim city, a city with a strong Asian and Native and Latin presence.
Argent Lane, Argent Street, Beryl Lane, Beryl Street. I grew up in Broken Hill, a mining town in the remote outback, where the streets are named after what lies below, underground. It resonates with me still.
Galena Street, Garnet Street, Graphite.
Places sound to me. I hear them as a sound map, but all the senses are engaged in registering place. In his beautiful book, Landscape and Memory, Simon Sharma observed that entering and moving through a deep wood of tall Douglas fir trees gave him a sensation of time warp, as though he'd entered a passageway, not merely of vegetation, but of time. That sense of layered history embedded in place takes time to piece together and understand, as Nadia Wheatley did in conceiving her novel My Place, a time capsule of a place real and imagined.
The key research was done by looking at a series of old maps of a particular area, the area that relates to the area around the suburbs of St Peter's, Erskineville, Newtown, the Alexandra Canal, the Cooks River in Sydney, and working my way through the layers of the map to deconstruct the landscape from the present urban landscape back to the Aboriginal landscape that, of course, still lies under every city.
Like Simon Sharma, whose sources were not only historical documents and images, but the archive of the feet, Nadia Wheatley has walked her way into place to understand history experientially.
We're in Kendrick Park, in the suburb of Tempe, approaching the banks of the Cooks River, and we're looking at Fatima Island, or the little bit of Fatima Island that we can see at the moment.
Nadia took me walking through the landscape of her book, showing me things I couldn't see from the train, and the significance of something that I could. A few square metres of tiny island, once a vital Indigenous crossing point, ebbing and flowing with the tide in the Cooks River near Sydney Airport.
We're looking south across the river to the new high-rise developments of Walleye Creek going up as we speak. And we can also see the grand, though rather small, colonial mansion known as Tempe House, which gave its name to this area, named after the Vale of Tempe in Greece.
We're sandwiched where we stand between the Princes Highway, which goes into the city of Sydney, and the railway bridge, which I travel over, in fact, even yesterday, looking back towards Fatima Island, and I have never seen Tempe House. I've always wondered where it was.
Yes, so looking at the island, Fatima Island, to me, is the most fabulous microcosm of the whole history of this island continent. We're looking at a very, very significant Aboriginal part of the landscape. So this is very similar, though we're on the river rather than the canal, to the landscape in the book My Place, where the Aboriginal people made their homes, their ngurra, beside the river or beside the canal to get the rich food resources, not just the fish and the shellfish, but also to get the birds. And also, of course, in the freshwater tributaries, which were all along the Cooks River here, people would have got the animals, wallabies, goannas, different animals coming down to the water to drink. But it also has a very important post-Indigenous settler story. This was farmland, and islands attract people for picnics and parties. We know that children used to come across here even as recently as the 1960s and gather on the island. In the 1950s, the history of this little island took an interesting multicultural turn. There was a priest at the local Catholic parish of St. Peter and St. Paul who was involved in the anti-communist campaign outlined by the Pope of that time to try to fight communism by instigating the devotion of Our Lady of Fatima from Portugal. And the priest here had a copy of her made, and processions of people used to go up and down the Prince's Highway at night with torches, carrying Our Lady of Fatima to bring the flock back to the church and to discourage communism. Our Lady was actually put onto the island and given her little grove there, and at that time the island acquired the name of Fatima Island. With time, with floods, the shrine and the grotto and the statue of Our Lady of Fatima were washed away, but the name somehow got onto the maps. And so we now come to the next stage of very interesting multicultural history, with Muslim people coming to the neighbourhood, and indeed there's a small mosque in one of the streets nearby. They saw the name Fatima Island on the maps, and Fatima, of course, is the beloved daughter of the Prophet Muhammad. And so it was as if in coming to the new land, they saw a place that had already been sanctified for them as a Muslim pilgrimage place. And so any weekend when you come down here, you'll see vast groups of Muslim picnickers here, all enjoying themselves and looking at the island.
It's extraordinary because I've seen that over the years and not appreciated that connection. I knew it was a lovely place here by the river with the shady trees, but yes.
Unfortunately, the wonderful Indigenous and multicultural history of Fatima Island may only be this kind of metaphor for the big history of our island continent for a few more years. They've decided to let it disappear under the tide. If this happens, it's going to be a significant loss of Aboriginal heritage, of Catholic heritage, of Muslim heritage, and of settler heritage. One of the lost places. It'll be a metaphor for neglect and lack of respect.
There's such a lot going on. We're near the airport. You know, there's a rumble of aircraft. There's a major highway, a train, development, and yet such a lot of history here, isn't there?
I'm beginning to think of the geography of history.
You want to go down to the Midden?
Yes, let's go to the Midden.
This is sometimes revealed through a process of creative mapping.
I believe that whatever historical period or topic we're engaged with, we cannot do history without geography, that we have to get a strong sense of the place. When people are mapping their area, they are forming a historical record as well as a geographic record. What it is a form of mental mapping. It's a form of mapping of the heart or mapping of the spirit, as well as mapping community and mapping landscape. This form of mapping is as much a form of writing as it is a form of drawing.
Memory and place are very related, aren't they?
Maps too are layers. When we do the simplest map, we're bringing a sense of past into it. And so this came to play in the book My Place, where there's a series of 20 maps, each one of them 10 years apart.
In essence, maps are memory maps, or Memoirs of Place. Rebecca Solnit has brilliantly reinvented the Atlas with two exquisite books of unique maps of the imagination and memory, charting place in New Orleans and San Francisco, aided by artists, cartographers, and writers. They don't map the predictable streets, but such things as San Francisco locations used by Alfred Hitchcock in making his film Vertigo. Another mapped butterfly habitats and queer bars and clubs that flourished in San Francisco, providing cocoons of safety and liberating transformations.
That was a map called Monarchs and Queens, Butterfly Species in Queer Public Spaces. And it was one of the first maps I developed when I was working on that atlas years back. And it was partly about celebrating San Francisco, which is the tip of a peninsula with its own weather and climate inside a region that's Mediterranean, in a state that's very separate from and different than the continental U.S. in both weather and culture. And so it's really looking at it as a kind of refuge where species, cultural and biological, might flourish that don't flourish elsewhere. And as a place with a kind of island biogeography where things sort of flourish and become eccentric and evolve in ways they might not on the mainland. And there's also about efficient use of maps. You know, if you map only queer public spaces, they're all pretty much in the built environment, so you're going to leave all this unpaved San Francisco behind. And the same with butterflies, who are all in the kind of unpaved spaces, and so they literally fit together on their different territories. And then, of course, there's a lot of other overlaps. The word mariposa and butterfly in Spanish is slang for a gay man, sort of derogatory slang. And the wonderful poet Aaron Shuren wrote an essay to go with that map, since atlases are books of essays as well as maps, in which he used all these metaphors of cocoons and metamorphosis and hatching out and spreading your wings and flying to talk about coming to a place like San Francisco and liberating yourself as a gay man or a queer person. And then the artist Mona Carone made a completely gorgeous set of drawings to go on the map, and it was one of the really, really successful total collaborations between concept, research, cartography, design, art, and writing.
It's quite a marvelous way to be able to visualize things and conceptualize and in a sort of graphic and poetic way. And I think they're very beautiful, those atlases.
Thank you. That was the goal, was to bring paper maps back into people's hands and to make them as beautiful and eccentric as they had ever been in any of the golden ages of maps. And, you know, I worry about a kind of post-paper map world, because we don't learn anything from our phones and GPS devices. We obey them, learn nothing, and need to use them every time and become dependent on them because we don't learn where we are. The more times you learn, use a map, which requires you to do much more interactive navigational thinking, the more the map becomes part of you until you are the map and you no longer unfold a piece of paper, because you know how this boulevard meshes into that and where to turn and how the streets are named and where the left turns can be made and so forth and so on.
On Facebook, I belong to the groups Lost Sydney and Broken Hillites Who Live Away From Home, in which amateur history sleuths share information and photos of long-gone but loved places, unlocking and piecing together puzzles and larger pictures of community, honouring the past, carrying memoir forward. It's a fascinating, productive use of social media and virtual space, but it's on the ground the visceral experience of place really feeds knowledge. So where are we now?
We've just travelled from the Cooks River up to what's now known as Sydney Park, a pretty recent park, on the site of an enormous old brick pit. We can see the iconic three brick pit chimneys just behind us. And as we walk into the park, we suddenly see something very recent and new that's going on. Indeed, we're moving here from history into a bit of future fiction.
So on to Campbell Street, I'll be seeing for the first time and hopefully not the last.
Mm-hmm.
even in one city, who you are in the rich and the poor district, the place where people are your color and where they're another color, where it's boring and safe and a bit dangerous, where there's lots of junkies and where there's lots of snotty shoppers. Your identity is always shifting. It's always contingent. It's always circumstantial. And thus our identities are geographical too.
Of course, San Francisco is in the vicinity of Silicon Valley. What have you been able to observe over time of the impact, I suppose, back on the city itself?
I was just writing my publisher at Harper's a letter where I compared Silicon Valley to a snake unhinging its jaws so it could swallow the soft, idealistic bunny that is San Francisco. It's been very sad for me because I've always felt that San Francisco and the Bay Area, we were an edge, and the United States, New York, and Washington, D.C. were the center, and we were 3,000 miles away as an edge. And centers have their value. You know, it's center stage, it's the limelight, a lot of power is transacted there. But in the shadows and the margins, marvelous things happen. I think it's where things are really born and develop, where insurrections and transformations come from. And the Bay Area had always been an edge of this sort of creative and generative and a little bit marginal and oppositional to the country. And now we're not just at the center of the country in some ways, but the center of the world. I go to some place like Iceland and people are using the Google search engine and they're on Facebook and they have iPhones and iPads and MacBooks and things. And I realize like all these products are created and controlled from my part of the world. And, you know, it's very strange for it to become this center and for it to be such a tremendously powerful center without anybody really having consented to it, intended it, designed it that way. You know, it's not something people in Australia or Austria or Thailand said, yes, we would really like all these crazy white boys in California to control the future. But it's sort of shaping up that way.
We're standing in Campbell Street, St. Peter's, and on the other side of the road, we're looking at the remaining terrace of six houses in Campbell Street. Of course, some late 19th century terrace housing is very grand, but these are narrow terraces. They've always been only one door onto the upstairs balcony. They've always been housing for poor people, and now it's these houses that are under threat. This is the road that I used as the archetypal road for my place and the road that's going to be one of the feeder roads for the new St. Peter's interchange. Indeed, one of the houses has on its balcony a sign that says, "Save the Inner West, Stop West Connects." So we're right in the heart of West Connects territory here.
For writers Nadia Wheatley and Rebecca Solnit, attachment to place and the risk of amnesia when some place becomes no place at all is the spark for the activist spirit.
Until just last Sunday, I've never spoken, as it were, in a political context about the My Place book, and I've also always avoided linking the book specifically with this landscape. It's my sense of the loss of this community and landscape that's made me now come out, as it were, about the real landscape that provided my basis for developing the fictional landscape.
I really came to see that democracy is an embodied physical, spatial thing. Things happen in the streets, democracy and connection and political change in a way that happens nowhere else. I think it's important just as a human being and as a citizen to participate in that, but it's also my subject matter as a writer. You know, the activism allows me to essentially witness history as it's unfolding, the history to create some kind of deeper background and context for the activism. And the writing is, you know, my kind of great avocation. If I was religious, I'd say what I was put here to do a lot of my writing about activism and my interest in trying to frame what a self is in a larger sense. In a sense, the memoir is the self as a subject in the psychological, therapeutic sense. But I want a self that's a soul and a citizen as well. And those things often get left out of the kind of privatized, secularized, depoliticized way we're taught to tell our stories. And a lot of my agenda or goal or vision has been to give back people these other stories, these other loves, this sense of a larger self.
Ruminating on place and the disappearance of things is at its best not a retreat to nostalgia or the denial of transformational change, but an embrace of the fertilizing effects of memory.
We need to have these markers of history, of the past, to enable us to have a sense of the future.
Simon Sharma so perceptively wrote, "Though it may sometimes seem that our impatient appetite for produce has ground the earth to thin and shifting dust, we need only poke below the subsoil of its surface to discover an obstinately rich loam of memory. The sum of our pasts, generation laid over generation, like the slow mould of the seasons, forms the compost of our future. We live off it." This is very lovely here. We're walking through, well, past some mangroves, through a grove of casuarina, and there are a few nice gathering points.
Right along here, there's evidence of Aboriginal life, if you know how to look for it. The landscape itself, the place itself, is the heritage. The place tells you the story if you open up your eyes to look at it.
There is an absence in your map, in the end pages of the Encyclopedia of Trouble and Spaciousness, and Australia seems terra incognita to you.
You know, it's pretty far away, and there's so many interesting people and places, and someday I'll get down there, but it hasn't happened yet.
RN. You've been listening to Earshot and Time Warp, a memoir of place. That was by Robin Ravlich, with writers Nadia Wheatley in Sydney and Rebecca Solnit in San Francisco. Book details are on the Earshot website at abc.net.au/RN, and the sound engineer was Mark Don.